Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks so much for joining us. Today, we're talking about the war in Syria and the destruction of antiquities. The human casualties of this war are, as we all know, immense. Some reports estimate that several hundred thousand people, maybe nearly half a million, have been killed. And the war is fueling the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. But the conflict is also striking at the heart of Syria's identity. It is a country with a long, rich cultural history, which in some sense belongs to all of us. Syria is one of the birthplaces of human civilization. Aleppo is one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world. In this war, it has experienced some of the heaviest fighting. The ruins of Ebla, a city first settled more than 5,000 years ago, have seen looting and military occupation. In the ancient city of Palmyra, ISIS has intentionally destroyed the iconic Arch of Triumph and a 2,000-year-old temple to a Mesopotamian god. Mosques, museums, castles, and gravesites all have taken a hit. Amid the human casualties, protecting these historical sites has necessarily taken a back seat. But many organizations and individuals are trying to document the destruction and preserve what remains. Among them is one of our guests. Amer Al-Azam is Associate Professor of History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio. He is the founder of The Day After Project, an organization dedicated to planning transition from the regime of Bashar al-Assad. He manages the organization's Heritage Protection Initiative. Amer al-Azam joins us from the studios of WOUB in Athens, Ohio. Welcome to Midday.
Hello, thank you.
We're very glad to have you. And here in the studio with us is Glenn Schwartz. He is Whiting Professor of Archaeology at Johns Hopkins University and Chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies. He spent three decades doing field work in Syria and is the author of The Archaeology of Syria, which covers the period from 16,000 B.C. to 300 B.C. Glenn Schwartz, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Amer al-Azam, I would like to start with you with a question that may be on the minds of some of our listeners. Why should we direct our energies toward preserving antiquities in Syria when this war is causing so much human suffering?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, really, I'm asked, you know, why do you care about cultural heritage? Why do you care about stones when people are dying every day? And for me, it's not a binary. It's not an either or. You have to care about one or the other. The two are inextricably linked. You know, Syrians are identified by their cultural heritage. Cultural heritage is one of the few areas that Syrians still agree across this terrible divide that has ruptured their society. And really, with cultural heritage, it's one of the few ways we can use to reach across this divide and maybe still be able to communicate with each other once this conflict is over. And so for me, saving Syria's cultural heritage is about saving Syria's future too. And just remember that people without their cultural heritage are a lost people. They have no identity. And similarly, a cultural heritage with no people to connect it to are just inanimate objects that might as well be just dumped in a museum and left there with no context, if you wish.
When you talk about the role that cultural heritage can play after the conflict in bringing combatants together, are you including ISIS in that?
Well, no, I'm not including ISIS per se. ISIS is an entity, is an organization, it's an ideology, so you wouldn't necessarily include it as such, but I'm including all Syrians, potentially also Syrians who may have been involved on the side of ISIS for whatever reasons they have chosen to do so. When we talk about culture, when we talk about national identity, we're talking about a Syrian national identity, not an ideology that spans different countries, different people, different ethnicities, etc.
So when you talk about pulling things together, you are assuming though that long-term Syrians, people with a Syrian identity, will be able to pull together after this.
Yes, I mean, let me just frame it a little better. I mean, bear in mind that this cultural heritage that is being decimated. Both sides, in fact, people on all sides of this of this terrible conflict, do seem to attribute some a significant amount of importance to it and do recognize it. I mean, everybody, every Syrian knows who Queen Zenobia is, the queen who ruled Palmyra, who Palmyra is associated with. Every Syrian knows who she is. We're very familiar. Every Syrian knows what Ebla is. Every Syrian knows what Ras Shamra is, the birthplace of the earliest alphabet. So these are, and it doesn't matter whether you're on the regime side, whether you're on the opposition side, whether even if you're an Islamist, you know these things. And so in working to preserve this cultural heritage, you're also providing yourself with a means of communicating, of reaching out. Okay, I don't agree with the other side on so many things, but at least we can talk about this one thing. And that starts that slow process of bridge building, if you want. Consider that this conflict will end one day, as all conflicts do. And people are going to have to look around to find something, some common denominator, some common ground that they can begin to communicate with each other, begin to talk to each other about. And I think cultural heritage can really play a very vital role in that. And that's why it's so important to preserve it for beginning from now.
Glenn Schwartz, as I mentioned, you spent 32 years doing field work in Syria.
Yeah, off and on.
Not continuously. But, okay, yeah. And you wrote a book about the archaeology of Syria. Give us a sense, if you can summarize it. I imagine you're used to doing this for American audiences. Give us a sense of how rich the archaeological heritage is.
Oh, it's probably one of the richest in the world. When you think that settled life, where people settling down, right, where they were no longer hunters and gatherers in a Paleolithic way of life, and began living in villages and began agriculture, that happened for the first time in Syria very, very early. So Syria has one of the oldest records of settled life. So you get, it goes back to at least something like 10,000, 12,000 BC. And of course that transition from hunting and gathering to settled agricultural village life is one of the great watersheds in human history. So you can try to study that especially well in Syria because they are one of the first places where it happened. And then after a few thousand years, you see the rise of urban civilizations. So big cities, kingdoms, writing, monumental architecture, art, and so forth. And that's, Syria is also precocious in that way, that it starts early. So there's a very long and rich record of human settled life and human urban life in Syria. And then also a lot of these great cities that are thousands of years old, like you mentioned, they have been continuously occupied. So there's a record of buildings that date back hundreds, even thousands of years that still have been standing in Syrian cities.
I read that there are quite a few very old buildings that until this war were still being used, not just to look at, but actually part of daily life. Amir al-Azam, does that make these buildings more vulnerable or less vulnerable in a conflict like this?
I don't know whether it necessarily, you know, contributes to the vulnerability per se, but the fact that they are still used really just adds so much to the richness that Glenn was just mentioning right now, that this is not just dead archaeological areas, you know, that there's no people. These are living archaeological sites with real human context. So you think of sites like Basra, where the archaeological city, the ancient city of Basra, the archaeological site, and the modern houses of the town and village are intermingled amongst each other. You think of cities like Aleppo and Damascus, where, old and new meet. Some of the parts of the old souks of Aleppo date back to the 12th century and were still, until recently, until the conflict, were being used as real markets, still selling the same. Some of the products changed. Obviously, you have modern, you have plastics and you have modern goods as well. But also ancient goods, traditional materials like spices and herbs that have been on sale in these markets for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. All of this really adds to the value and richness of this incredible culture that is just being decimated right now as we speak.
That's Amir Al-Azam, Associate Professor of History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and here with me in the studio is Glenn Schwartz, archaeologist from Johns Hopkins. We're talking about the destruction of antiquities and archaeological richness in Syria because of the war. You can be part of this conversation. Have you visited any of these sites in Syria that we've been mentioning? What do you remember? If you'd like to call us, our number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. We've referred to the destruction of several places, and I'd like to ask each of you before we take our first break. Glenn Schwartz, let me start with you. What should people understand, highlight for us something that you know has been lost that people should understand?
Well, Palmyra is probably the most prominent example because Palmyra is really extremely special, unique probably. And there's so many freestanding, beautiful, monumental buildings from the Roman period or from 2,000 years ago when Palmyra was a rich, powerful city right in the middle of the desert. It's an oasis town. And I suppose because the town wasn't, after the Romans took it over and then it fell out of use, it wasn't rebuilt. So these ancient buildings were allowed to just keep standing. Nobody, knocked them down or rebuilt them. So they're really a remarkable monument of life in a powerful Syrian caravan city from 2,000 years ago, in a beautiful setting. And the buildings themselves are beautiful. Just the color of the stone in the desert light is beautiful. So the destruction of some of the most iconic buildings in Palmyra is really a terrible tragedy and just heartbreaking to hear about.
Amir Al-Azam, should we think of Palmyra as having been leveled? Or, I mean, what has happened there?
No, I mean, Palmyra is obviously a massive site, and what has been physically destroyed by ISIS, the huge publicity that surrounded the Temple of Bel, the Baal Shamin, and the Arch of Triumph, and so on and so forth, they are really very important landmarks, but they are just part of a much larger site, and there still are enormous, huge remains. But I should also want to stress that the real damage that is happening to Syria's cultural heritage is not from these, individual single acts of terrible violence, such as where ISIS blows up a temple or a building. It's from the persistent and intensive looting that is going on. That's what's really, really, really taking the heart out of Syria's cultural heritage, far more destructive, far less reported, and it's really happening all over Syria in regime-held areas, in opposition-held areas, in ISIS-held areas, people are mostly non-state actors, local people are trying to do their best to protect it, and that's for me where the real story is, even though. And from a publicity, from a media perspective, we like to focus on what ISIS and the terrible atrocities that ISIS has done. And for me, for example, the greatest tragedy is the fact that my children will never be able to see the sun rise and hit that little window in the Temple of Bel, and then suddenly the temple explodes into this huge fireball as it lights up. This is something that none of my children will never be able to experience, and it really saddens me. But I have to also put it into the bigger context of all this looting and so many other sites. I wouldn't even know where to begin if I were to try and count the damage that's been done.
You have teed up exactly, I think, where we should pick up our conversation after we take this short break. We'll talk more about the looting in this war in Syria and the impact on the country's cultural heritage. Be part of this conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. Why do you think ISIS is intentionally destroying these antiquities? What do you think should be done about all the looting that Amir Al-Azam just mentioned? Give us a call or send us an email. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the conflict in Syria and the destruction of archaeological sites and historical artifacts there, and the looting of antiquities. We're talking to Amr al-Azm, an outspoken member of the Syrian opposition. Amr al-Azm is a former Syrian antiquities official and led archaeological research at the University of Damascus. And here with me in the studio is Johns Hopkins archaeologist Glenn Schwartz. He spent more than 30 years doing field work in Syria. He is chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins. Amr al-Azm, you pointed us to concern about looting. Tell me the extent of that. It was already going on, was it not, even before the war or not?
I mean, yes. The looting is as old as the history of the region. And in fact, as long as people have been burying their dead with valuables, you would have had looting of some sort going on. Just think of the pyramids and all the other tomb sites and so on and so forth. But and in Syria, like anywhere else, before the conflict, there was looting that occurred on certain sites, even senior regime members of the regime were often implicated in the trade and dealing of looted antiquities. But what happens with the conflict, and this is what we see from as the nature of the conflict between 2011 and 2012 shifts from one of peaceful protests, civil activism, to an armed confrontation between regime and opposition, that's when we start to see this huge increase in damage to Syria's cultural heritage, both on the battlefield because it becomes a battlefield casualty, it's on the front lines, but more importantly, it becomes a casualty of looting, as essentially the large swathes of Syria are no longer under any sort of, there's no state control, there's no administration, there's no infrastructure, there's no, governance. It breaks down, and so these archaeological sites just become a free-for-all, and anybody and everybody starts to help themselves. So you have the original criminal elements, or you might call the looting mafias, taking advantage of this void, this vacuum, but also locals who have lost their means of, feeding themselves, feeding their families, because they've lost their jobs, they've lost their means of providing for themselves, so they resort to this available source that is looting, and we call this subsistence looting. And then all of this gets incredibly amplified and intensified when ISIS then appears on the scene at the end of 2013 and in 2014, when they take over large swathes of territory, both in Syria and Iraq. They institutionalize the process of looting. They make it a part of the state's source of revenue. They place it under the Diwan al-Rikaz, the Office of Resources, which essentially means anything buried underground, oil, mineral wealth, and archaeological material artifacts, all become a primary source of income for the state. They issue licenses, and really that's when we see this, and particularly in areas under ISIS, we see this very aggressive, very intensive looting activity. But you look across Syria, you look in the south, in the area of Deraa, you look in Idlib, look at the site of Apamea. We've all seen those awful, awful satellite images of before and after. The site of Mari, all of these sites, and even in Palmyra, looting was going on when the regime was in control of the site. I have seen items offered on sale even as recently as a few months ago that were looted when the regime was in charge, and then we have items that are coming up on sale now in the auctions, the ISIS auctions, that were looted when ISIS was in charge.
Glenn,
it's incredible.
Pull Glenn Schwartz into this conversation of Amr al-Azm just mentioned icons, but what can you give me a clearer idea of some of the – what kinds of items are we talking about being looted and sold?
Well, there's quite a range of possibilities. If you dig a hole in an ancient site, you're likely to find pottery and some quite beautiful pieces of pottery. Find burials, you're likely to find jewelry. If you're lucky, so to speak, you could find gold, silver, jewelry, things like that. Well, beautifully crafted objects. You can find items that were used for, you might say, business or administration. So written records, you can find clay tablets that they wrote on the cuneiform writing system. All of those things fetch a price on the antiquities market.
And that's my other question. Who is buying these?
Well, over the past, 100 years or so, there's been a market for antiquities, Middle Eastern and other antiquities, in Europe and the United States in particular. There's people who like the rarity and the beauty of these objects, and they like to collect them. And museums themselves, would collect too, sometimes from ultimately looted contexts. And then more recently, I think, the appetite for such things has unfortunately spread over other parts of the world. And so I think some of the Persian Gulf states, for example, there's, I think, a certain amount of antiquities collecting there now too, Japan, maybe China. So the markets, it started out in the West, so to speak, but it has broadened in recent years.
And Amir al-Azam, I would think from the way you're describing it, that the market would be flooded, that the value of these antiquities would be plummeting because there's so much being put on this black market.
Well, the prices, there are times when the prices have crashed. And at one point in late 2014 and early 2015, I heard that people were actually giving up because it was no longer profitable. But this is something that goes up and down. It's a supply and demand thing. Right now, for example, because the Turkish government has really tightened and clamped down on their borders, it's become much, much harder to move material from Syria into Turkey. So, and that has led in part to a decline or crash, if you want, in the price of goods inside Syria because material is piling up, but made it much more expensive to get it from Turkey because of the difficulty in getting it across the border. Whereas across Lebanon, it's become much easier. So and these are sort of local market variations that
market
are constantly
forces, yeah.
Yes, that are constantly in flux. But really, the real issue here for me is, this is not. It's not like suddenly you walk into any store in New York or in London or wherever, and you're going to find the market awash with this stuff. This is a very carefully managed market. Most of these items are being bought by dealers on the ground, from looters to dealers who specialize in this kind of stuff, who then sell it to other dealers, who will eventually put it into their basements. And we're talking really about the really valuable stuff, the stuff that's worth tens of thousands of dollars. That's the real. That's where the real money is, not the trinkets and baubles that you might find. And this stuff will eventually end up in somebody's basement. They'll sit on it for maybe 5, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. And there's a long process of cleaning it up. By cleaning it up, I mean laundering it so that it becomes sellable. You have to build a provenance for this item. Sometimes you can fake it. You can provide fake paperwork. But more often than not, there also has to be – it's a very slow, laborious process. These people know what they're doing. They've been doing it for a long time, and this is a well-established and very ingrained market out there, and we really have barely started to touch the surface of this.
That's Amir al-Azam, Associate Professor of History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio, here on Midday on WYPR. And here with me in the studio is Glenn Schwartz, Chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins. As an archaeologist, he worked for more than three decades doing field work in Syria. We're talking about the destruction of antiquities and the looting that's taking place in Syria. You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Sean has phoned us from Baltimore. Sean, welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you very much. I just wanted to say I traveled to the archaeological site of Baalbek in Lebanon this April. And once you've been to one of these big archaeological sites, it really hits you. What a loss to all of us something like what happened at Palmyra is, because they really are triumphs of humanity and heritage to all of us.
I appreciate your making that point. Glenn or Amir al-Azam, a response to Sean?
Well, it's true. I think It's not just the value historically, what we know, what we learn about the human past from looking at these monuments, but there's also an aesthetic quality. Some of them are just amazingly beautiful and are just among the world's great treasures of beauty. And it's to try to reconstruct them or replicate them, as sometimes has been discussed, say for Palmyra, you're not going to be able to recapture the quality that the original had, unfortunately.
It's true of most replicas. Amr Al-Azm, we haven't really talked about the work that the Day After Project is doing. Talking about looting, for example, how are you trying to address that?
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought it up because I feel like I've really been dragging the tone down, and I'd like to say something a little more positive to our listeners here. I mean, obviously, the situation is very dire, but there are people who are doing their best. They're trying very, very hard to either mitigate the damage or to actually document this damage, to make sure that at least we have a record of what was there for the future. And the Day After organization, as you mentioned, and by the way, I'm not the founder, I'm a founder. I'm one of a group of people who worked very hard to put this together. And we have, as part of that, a heritage protection initiative, which is what I coordinate. And in that, we've managed to reach out to a number of activists, archaeologists, museum curators who are inside Syria, who essentially live and work in areas outside regime control. So they have none of the benefits of the state institutions and the support that these state institutions get, say, from international organizations like UNESCO. They are non-state actors. They're out on their own. They have no support whatsoever. And they are doing their best. They go out there every day. They try to document this damage. They try to photograph it. They file. They gather this information. They try to sort of track looted antiquities where looting occurs. They try at least to take some sort of photo, some sort of image, some sort of documentation, so that they probably won't be able to prevent the looting, but at the very least we have that record so that one day if this item does appear on the international market, say 5 or 10 years from now, we can turn around and say, this piece was looted on such and such a day, give it back to us. And a third, and this is also another thing that they do, is these mitigation projects where they essentially try to protect museums that still have their items in there. One example would be the Mara Museum in Idlib. This is a joint project between ourselves at TDA and ASOR, the American School of Oriental Research. And previously, we also had a similar project at the same site with the Smithsonian and the Penn Cultural Heritage Museum. And what we've done is we've sandbagged the contents of the museum, which are really, really important. There are these incredible mosaics from a group of World Heritage, UNESCO-designated World Heritage sites known as the Dead Cities. They're kept in this museum in Mara, and we've managed to sandbag and safeguard the contents of that museum. And just in the nick of time, because the museum has been struck twice by an airstrike, the first time in June of last year, 2015, when serious damage occurred to the museum. And again, 3 days ago, the museum was struck by two rockets from a regime airstrike and caused grievous damage to parts of the museum. But because of the sandbagging, because of the efforts of these people, and for me, they are the heroes of our story here. They've managed to save the mosaics. None of the mosaics, the important mosaics, including a very, very rare and very important mosaic known as the Hercules, which people can look up online if they wish, which is kept in the Mara Museum. That was saved because it was so well sandbagged and kept. And this is the sort of activity that the site monitoring teams are working with the TDA, which essentially provides them an institutional framework for them to operate. Now, we raise funds for them. We provide training for these people on the ground inside Syria. But it's we're one organization and there is so much work to do. And, we're just barely scratching the surface.
You're using an acronym that I'm not catching quickly enough. You said you work with the PDA?
TDA.
The day after.
That's the acronym for that, yes.
This sounds very dangerous, the work that you're describing.
It is. It is. I can tell you that in the most recent airstrike, which occurred 3 days ago, one of our guys was injured, only lightly, I have to add. It was not a serious injury. About a week before that, again, our team leader with some of his guys were driving, coming back from actually a site visit, not far from Mara, and the town that they were driving through suddenly had, you know, was hit by an airstrike, and their car was damaged, but they were safe. Last year, one of our field guys, one of our site monitors, had his home, the village he lived in, struck with a chlorine gas bomb. His wife and children had to be, evacuated to Turkey because they had inhaled all this chlorine gas. Mm. And remember, this shelling, these are not frontline sites. These guys are not on the front lines. This is indiscriminate shelling, indiscriminate bombardment of civilian centers, civilian towns, villages, where there is no actual fighting. And they are indiscriminately targeting these sites, and when you're indiscriminate in your target, and I'm talking here about the regime and the Russians specifically here, when you target these sites indiscriminately and you drop the bomb, you don't know what it will hit. It hits a market, it hits a museum, it hits a hospital, and they do it systematically to intimidate and to terrorize the local civilian population. There are no front lines there.
You have raised a point that I would like to understand better, and I think we're going to take a quick break here, and then I'll ask you. I'm trying to get a sense of whether it is ISIS that is responsible for most of the troubles we're talking about, or many many actors in this very violent and distressing war. So as I said, we're going to take a short break and then continue our conversation about the antiquities and archaeological heritage that is being has been destroyed in Syria and what is being done to try to minimize that. You can be part of this conversation if you send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the damage the war in Syria has inflicted on the country's cultural heritage, particularly its museum artifacts, ruins, other archaeological sites, as well as the looting that is going on. I'm speaking with Amr Al-Azm, Associate Professor of History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio. He's joining us from the studios of WOUB in Athens, Ohio. Here in our studio is Glenn Schwartz, Chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins, an archaeologist who has spent much of his career working in Syria. What are your thoughts as you listen to this description? What would you like to know about archaeology in Syria or the destruction that is happening there? What do you think the international community should do to stop the destruction of antiquities in Syria? You can email us at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Amr Al-Azm, let me pick up where I said I would. I'm hearing the description of some of what's gone on. I don't have a sense. Is ISIS responsible for most of the destruction, or are all the parties to blame?
Quite simply, all the parties have had a hand in the destruction of Syria's cultural heritage. The regime has definitely been derelict in its duty to protect its cultural heritage. It has indiscriminately bombarded, rocketed, fired upon sites that are World Heritage Sites. I would remind you the Crac du Chevalier was very heavily damaged by the regime airstrikes and bombardment when they were trying to dislodge opposition fighters who were based there back in late 2013 and 2014. The burning of the souks of Aleppo in 2012 is another example of destruction by the regime. The opposition, obviously where there are front lines, and particularly in Aleppo with all the tunneling bombs that they've used, again, caused incredible amounts of damage to the ancient city itself. And now we have the Russians as well with their indiscriminate bombardment. They've bombed, for example, the site of Shansharah, which is part of the World Heritage, the World Heritage site, designated sites of the dead cities. They've bombed Ebla about a month and a half ago, I think. And even now in Palmyra, as everybody, or let's say the Russians and some people were celebrating the Russians supposedly rescuing Palmyra from ISIS, we've just found out that they've sited a military base. They've built a significant military base there right in the middle of the archaeological site. It's clearly for combat operations. It has heavy tracked vehicles, and these are going to have heavy tracked vehicles driving around an archaeological site is going to do incredible damage to the site. The crushing effect of these of the vehicles, the vibrations, is just going to destroy everything that's left. And it's sited right in the middle of the archaeological site.
And of course, that makes the archaeological site a legitimate military target, too.
Well, potentially, but I would also remind our listeners that, remember, the U.S. itself was heavily criticized in 2003 when we here in the United States sited a military base at the ancient site of Babylon. And, we apologize for that. And the Russians, whilst they're sitting there claiming to be the only ones who essentially saved the world and saved Palmyra from ISIS, and they're going out and they're doing, this terrible. They site this military base right in the middle of the archaeological park, totally, with total disregard for the needs of the site and its protection. So everybody's guilty, yes. In terms of the question itself, is ISIS more destructive than anybody else? ISIS has a special brand of destruction. ISIS, because of the way ISIS sees cultural heritage, I think this is very important. ISIS sees cultural heritage as a resource, an exploitable resource, and it exploits it in as many ways as it can. It exploits every aspect of this cultural heritage. It loots what it loots what it can sell. It destroys what it can for propaganda purposes. It uses what it does not, what's left, for either as safe havens or bases for its forces, like they have at the site of Rasafa, or they use it to site, for example, oil installations. I have images of sites, archaeological sites in the areas that are being used to refine oil, and you can see these. And they know that these sites are not going to be struck by the coalition, and that's their biggest problem, coalition airstrikes. So they use these sites in a multitude of different ways. And for me, perhaps that is why ISIS is probably the most destructive, because they really have taken the exploitation of cultural heritage to a new level that everybody else is not really there yet.
Glenn Schwartz, you have looked at satellite photos, which I would not have thought that satellite photos could tell us much about looting, but you tell me they do.
Oh, yeah. In fact, the use of satellite photos has become a very important tool in archaeology in general. Sometimes it's called space archaeology, the use of these images from space. So if you look at photos from space and identify archaeological sites, you can see the holes where the looters have been digging. And it's really really quite disconcerting to look at these photos, because the sites look like Swiss cheese. They're just pockmarked with holes. And there have been studies that, there's this question, what can archaeologists do about this disaster? Well, we can't actually go to Syria. So one thing you can do is what Amr is talking about, where you can actually try to help the professionals inside Syria. And another is to try to document what's going on through these methods like satellite imagery. So, in fact, there have been a number of projects to try to do that. I was just reading an article by my colleague Jesse Cassana about this, and he was showing that looting is going on all over Syria, not just in the parts controlled by ISIS or the government, but in all the different sectors. But what he did note is that the intensity of the looting was much more pronounced in the ISIS-controlled area. And, of course, ISIS is the only entity that deliberately destroys archaeological materials. It deliberately destroys sites.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who was asking specifically about Turkey. This caller asserted, known for stealing items like the ones we've been discussing, and wanted to know whether Turkey is involved in the looting situation. Do either of you know?
I know. All I can tell you is that the Turkish authority, I mean, there are Turks who are involved in the trafficking of looted antiquities, just as there are Americans who are involved in the trafficking of looted antiquities. There are Brits. Trafficking of looted antiquities is endemic around the world. But as a state, as institutions, no, they're not. Obviously, they are doing their best to prevent that from happening. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, the recent closure or tightening of the borders over the last 12 months has really impacted the ability of people to smuggle looted antiquities across the border, so much so that it's affected the prices. The same object on one side of the border will fetch one price, and it's amplified 10, 20 times if you are then able to buy it on the other side of the border.
Glenn Schwartz, you got to a question which we certainly want to cover in this hour. You talked about what archaeologists can try to do. What should the international community be doing? And I'll ask you both that. And obviously, if they could end the war, that would be a great step forward. But in addition or beyond that, do you have any ideas about what ought to be done specifically about the cultural heritage?
Well, indeed, ending the war would be the best thing. So I recommend that. But otherwise, I think, well, there are, of course, a number of problems. One is the looting. The looting is extremely, extremely important problem. So if there were more governmental attempts to prevent looted objects from being sold outside of Syria, if we could, inhibit the antiquities trade and try and make sure that items that were looted from Syria don't get disseminated in other to other places, that would be an important thing, and of course supporting the efforts to try to help professionals inside Syria to safeguard their heritage, the kind of project that Amr was talking about. Those are some obvious steps that could be.
Amr al-Azam, what would you like to point to that the international community could do beyond?
Just as Glenn said, I mean, really, this is a supply and demand issue. So there's the supply side, and whilst the conflict is ongoing, there are limits to what can be done. We can document damage that is occurring. We can try and track looted antiquities, in and around Syria as far as we can go. Remember, most of these, the people who are doing this are not law enforcement agencies, so there are limitations to what they can do. And we can do these mitigation projects to try and protect museums, protect objects. And this is happening on both sides. This is one of the interesting aspects of this. Even as you have these highly polarized society and people fighting on both sides, on both sides, you have people on the regime side and you have people on the opposition side trying to save this cultural heritage. And to me, that's what makes all of this so remarkable. And then, obviously, on the demand side, that's where the international community can play a greater role. I believe the United Nations and the Security Council issued a ban on trade in looted antiquities from Syria and Iraq. More recently here, I think the president last week signed the Engel Bill, which again was supposed to provide legislation for to protect and prevent the trade and dealing in looted antiquities from Syria and Iraq. These are all obviously good steps in the right direction. But really, for me, until we have a very strong and meaningful way to make buyers and sellers really accountable, hold them accountable in terms of verifying and ensuring that whatever it is they're selling or buying is not looted, we're still going to get this, it's still going to be very gray, it's still going to be too many loopholes out there. And the concept of caveat emptor, a buyer beware, really should be enforced here. And it should be made very clear to people who are buying and selling that, look, if you understand that if you are not sure of what you're buying or selling, then don't do it. Because if you do buy and sell something that happens to be looted, you are very likely funding a terrorist organization like ISIS. And that alone should be enough warning for people to take extra care. And unfortunately, unless this is backed up by some sort of legislation that really reinforces the fact that if you are caught doing this, you're going to be prosecuted under a terrorism act of some sort, then there will always be people who turn a blind eye to this. And that's an unfortunate fact of our life.
So Glenn Schwartz, let me pick up on that. I envision, while Amar al-Azam is speaking, law enforcement, but given the market forces we talked about earlier, do museums need to be more clear that there is no way that a looted item is ever going to make it into our collection?
Well, museums in this country, anyway, are not so likely to be acquiring these looted objects. In these days, they have to be careful about what they acquire, and that the provenance has to be made clear. I think the problem is more private individuals who will buy these items, and a really good argument that Amr mentioned is the chances are if you buy one of these items, you're likely to be giving money to ISIS or a group like that. And is that what you want to be doing?
Is there something listeners can do? People who aren't in the market to buy these items, but is there something that listeners can do?
I suppose write your congressman to try to support measures to prevent antiquities from being sold, being brought from Syria into this country. Yeah.
Amar al-Azam, we're down to just a minute. Is there a message you would leave with listeners?
Yes, I would advocate for tighter controls on dealing of looted antiquities, and support in any way you can those who are working inside Syria, primarily as non-state actors, NGOs, volunteers, etc., trying to save this cultural heritage, not just for Syrians, but for the rest of us out here in the world too.
And that support, you say support any way you can. What specifically would you?
It can be financial. It can be professional. If you're an archaeologist, if you're a conservator and you have the ability to help out, or if you just want to make a donation, any way you can. You're not just doing it for Syrians. You're doing it for everybody else around the world, too.
Some resources on our website. I want to thank you. Amar al-Azam manages the Heritage Protection Initiative for the Day After, an organization dedicated to planning a transition from the current regime in Syria. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Glenn Schwartz, Whiting Professor of Archaeology at Johns Hopkins, Chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies there. So glad you could join us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features sandwiches, salads, specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. I'll be away for a couple of days, but Nathan Sterner will be here tomorrow to discuss the impact of the bicycle on American culture. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.